Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Where were you during the Vietnam War?
I was unborn when it began, and when Australia entered its first battalion in 65, as opposed to the training team in 62, I was in England living in Leeds, a toddler, a baby at my mum's house.
You didn't come out to Australia till long after the Vietnam War was over.
It was well over. I came out here, I arrived here in March 1989.
Yeah. So why the interest? When England wasn't part of it, or Britain was not part of the Vietnam War, it's not part of their history. It's part of Australia's history and the US history and many other countries, New Zealand. But why are you interested in a war that really your home country had nothing to do with when you were there?
Initially, I wasn't so much interested in the war. I was interested in national service. My father did his national service during the Korean War.
Right.
And he defended England against the North Korean threat in Sherwood Forest. They feared my father. You could just sort of tell.
Yeah.
But it always puzzled me. Like, my dad had spent these 2 years in the army and very much enjoyed it, the way he spoke about it. It was just kind of a comedy, because it kind of carry on soldiering for him. And yet to me, it seemed really quite brutal and terrifying. I became very interested in what the experience of national service really was when I was in my late 40s, by which time I was in Australia. And I discovered there had been a similar scheme here, a two-year national service scheme.
Yeah.
Although the one in England was universal, the two-year scheme here was selective. So that's where I came into this.
Right. And your book, Nashos, dealt with that.
The Nashos War, which is a military history book that came out October last year, was based on interviews with 150 Australian national servicemen who went to Vietnam and about a dozen national servicemen who didn't. But yeah, that dealt with the national service experience from ballot being called up, going into basic military training, corps training, and then time in Vietnam, and a little bit about when they got back home.
So what is the difference then between writing a book of fiction, which this is, and writing a non-fiction book, which the Nashos War was?
Well, curiously, as a journalist, people believe that you make up non-fiction, and yet fiction must be true because you couldn't have made it up. But for me, I mean, the lines were very, very clearly drawn. I wouldn't make up a word in the Nashos War. I checked everything as stringently as I possibly could, and yet still got some things wrong, whereas every word in R&R is made up. However, having said that, I wanted to make sure that the settings were realistic or at least feasible in R&R. R&R is set in Vung Tau, the logistics support town for Nui Dat, the forward base of Australian forces in Vietnam. And I went to Vung Tau and tried to ensure that at least the topography of my story was feasible.
Because the story begins with a potentially unfeasible situation where a body floats down the street in heavy rainfall out of a coffin. It's recently been buried and ends up outside a bar and then eventually ends up inside a bar. And that's where the story begins. And you went to extraordinary lengths to make sure that that could be possible.
I did. I first heard this story from an Australian National Service military policeman who had been stationed in Vung Tau and who told me when it rained heavily, the soils might part and bodies would flow from higher points in town to lower points in town and kind of float through the street. I didn't really believe this. I thought it was a folk tale. But I found a further reference to it in a memoir of a boat person who eventually settled in America, who had also lived in Vung Tau. So I thought, well, it's a possibility. So I went to Vung Tau with an Australian Vietnam veteran and tried to search for a point where this might occur, a spot where somebody could be buried and could feasibly then flow down the hill in heavy rainfall if they became disinterred through climatic factors. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, the guy I was with turned out not only to be an expert artilleryman, but an expert on soil. So at whatever hill I found or mound or dune, I said, well, could it work from here? I mean, what if it rained here? Would the soils part and the coffin go? Nah, mate. This is, I don't know, alluvial soil. Alluvial soil, when it makes contact with precipitation, rather than part, it compacts. So it would be buried even deeper. I'm not really interested in the soil aspect. I'm just saying, if it were a different kind of soil then, was it possible that the coffin could flow from here and into town? And eventually, rather begrudgingly, about the fifth hill that we found, he said, I suppose so, if it wasn't laterite. So I'm going to shut up.
But this is a made-up story. This is not fact. fact, it is fiction. You could have set it in a fictitious village, give it a completely fictitious name, and made up the story. Why didn't you want to do that?
Too hard. Basically, there's so much that you have to make up when you're writing a novel. It's so easy to become undisciplined. It's so easy to invent parallel universes that don't really make sense. I thought if I at least anchored it in geographical and historical fact, there'd be less that I would have to invent. It meant that there weren't so many options open for what could happen, and that forced me into a kind of joyous confinement. I was happy to have those rules. I was happy to be bound by the rules of geography and history while inventing this story around it.
They say that truth is stranger than fiction, but not in this book.
No, my fiction is definitely stranger than truth, because I doubt whether ever a body has, although bodies may well have come off hills and floated into town, I doubt whether they've been mistaken for a box of biscuits opened by two American GIs and then manipulated, to put it nicely, in such a way as they can then be taken into a bar, bought a drink, given a cigarette, at which point they are then shot dead, even though they're dead in the first place. Don't think that ever happened, to
be
frank. You're
not spoiling the book, by the way, because that all happens in the first...
Yeah. Well,
not even the first chapter, before the first chapter.
Yeah, the prologue.
But the story is then about an American MP, or he's not even really an MP, Nashville is his name, John Grant, and an Australian, Sean Long, known as Shorty, who are working together as provos. So was that the case in the Vietnam War? Did the Australians and the Americans work together like that?
They did for periods in Vung Tau. An Australian would patrol with an American, particularly on bars patrols. It was unclear who had jurisdiction over what troops. So if you had an Australian, American and a Vietnamese in the back, which was often the case, although rarely in my book, then you knew if you came to a disturbance, who could arrest who, kind of thing.
Mm. But then you also say a few times in the book that the Americans don't really even realise that the Australians are there in Vietnam.
No, I think the majority of Americans would have very little idea that that was the case. In Vung Tau it was clear, because in Vung Tau there's one ALSG, the Australian Logistics Support Base, but everywhere, most places where Americans were north of Phuc Thuy, there'd be very little chance of bumping into an Australian, maybe on a training team here and there.
So that's rather sad, considering that it created such a scar in the Australian public life, public culture, during the 60s and into the 70s, that our major ally didn't even know that we were there.
Yeah, imagine how it feels to be a New Zealander. Even... but yeah, I mean, our contribution, our military contribution to the Vietnam War was far smaller than, say, South Korea's. And how many Australians know, apart from military, know that South Korea was even there?
Yeah, interesting. Mark Dappin is our guest. The name of the book is R&R, and it's a, I can't even describe it as a murder mystery. It's a mystery, in a sense, of why a dead body was shot by a bloke with the wonderful name of, I think it was T.J. Caution. Caution. You could come up with any name in the world. How did you come up with the name of T.J. Caution?
I've no idea. I keep being asked this. I never thought I'd be asked this. I just want.
It's an unusual
I like
name.
The sound of it.
Okay.
Yeah, it did sound. It sounded kind of evil. Caution. Caution. Watch it, sort of thing.
The book is not about the fighting of the Vietnam War. In fact, there's very little fighting. There's a little bit of it, and of course, there's always tragedy in that. It's a kind of a sideshow of the war, isn't it?
It's really about men in the company of other men. It happens to be that the site of that. Those relationships is an R&R town in a war zone. But I wanted to write about the way men act when women aren't around, or when the kind of women that they can more or less act like aren't around them, i.e. Asian prostitutes. The story I wanted to tell was about men's language, men's callousness, men's humour and men's love for one another, I guess. I wasn't concerned about telling a story about the realities of battle or anything like
sure.
that. What would I know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, you talked to so many people, though, with your last book, or the book about the Nashos, that you must have got an idea of what it was like.
I've got an idea of how they remember it now, but I wouldn't say that I could really understand what they went through. And also, a vast number of them didn't go to any battles anyway.
Exactly.
A much more common experience would be to go on R&R than to get for Australian troops in Vietnam than to find themselves in battle.
Yeah, okay. Well, the Australian character then, Shorty, who's 6'5", he volunteers to go because his girlfriend or fiance is working there as a nurse. Was that a bit of a stretch? Was that something that actually might have happened, that somebody's fiance was working there and as a nurse and they wanted to go and sort of spend time with her?
Yeah, I mean, it might have. It didn't, but it could have. Yeah. There were Australian nurses there, small contingents throughout the war, and there were certainly the majority of men who ended up fighting in Vietnam as national servicemen or regulars certainly were willing to go there. It's completely forgotten. What we remember is the conscientious objectors, the moratorium demonstrations, the peace movement. But there were always more blokes who volunteered for national service, not just to go to Vietnam, but volunteered for national service when their number didn't come up than there were registered conscientious objectors. So there was a great enthusiasm among male Australian youth to go and fight in Vietnam, which has been absolutely forgotten.
Why was that, do you think? Because we, quote-unquote, lost the war?
Why has it been forgotten? Because it doesn't fit the story that has developed since.
That everyone was against the war and we shouldn't have been there. And
I think we now have a false picture of how things were at the end of the Vietnam War, which has grown up since both the fall of Saigon, by the end of Australia's Vietnam War, by which I mean 1972, we've grown up since both the fall of Saigon and the release of Rambo First Blood and a couple of other Hollywood movies. I think that much, although not all, but a great deal of what is said about the veterans, so for instance, not having welcome home parades is incorrect. There clearly a large number had welcome home parades, although some did not.
And there was an Anzac Day parade every year anyway.
There was an Anzac Day parade every year. So this idea has developed of, you know, veterans getting spat on, blood poured on them. It's massively exaggerated. What they are remembering, I think, is a single incident in 1966 when Nadine Jensen, a typist from Campbelltown, ran at a parade of 1st Battalion in Sydney. And a number of things that happened way after the war was over, when a group centred around Women Against Rape in War began to demonstrate at Anzac Day in various capitals. The reception that some veterans remember getting from the peace movement, I don't think actually occurred.
Controversial words from Mark Dappin. He's the author of R&R. Now, something else I don't know that is controversial, but it's really brought to the fore in the book, is the obsession that men have with women. Now, most men have some kind of an obsession with women, but is it exacerbated during a war?
Well, I think the thing was with troops in Vietnam, they didn't really see any women most of the time. Yeah, infantry, who were a large proportion of the Australian commitment to Vietnam and, you know, large proportion of the troops in Nui Dat, would go out in the field, in the bush for a month and never see anybody but the bloke in front of them or bloke beside them. So they'd let off steam once a year on R&R. They'd go to Southeast Asian or Asian capital for a week and finally see and speak to women. Or if they got down to Vung Tau on R&C, which was a shorter rest and convalescent leave for Australian troops, they might have a weekend with women. But the rest of the time, they were entirely in the company of men, unless they were stationed in Vung Tau, where there was a small contingent of nurses and, of course, the brothels and bars that the other troops used for R&C. So I think the less that you're with something that you crave, the more you think about it. But in the book, it's not really about being obsessed with women, except in the case of Nashville, who's simply obsessed with enjoying himself in any given situation. It's they kind of like talking about it. They like impressing each other talking about women, which I think men revel in.
Some of the other major characters in the book are the Vietnamese prostitutes, the locals, I suppose, in Vung Tau. So it's easier, I would presume, to do the research and talk to men who were there and find out what their experience was like. How do you know about the experiences of the women, especially if so many men coming back from a war would never talk about the R&R and what went on in the bars and the brothels?
No.
That's not part of the Anzac myth, is it?
Excuse me. Well, but it is all made up. The book is entirely made up. The men's experiences aren't real either, any more than the experiences of the Vietnamese women are real. It's just entirely from my imagination. Although I first went to Vietnam in 20-odd years ago, when it was recently been reopened and been able to individual travel for very long. And I actually met a bar girl, so-called, from back in the day, who still had Sean Flynn's business card in her wallet. But I thought nothing of it then. I certainly wasn't planning on writing a novel. So I have occasionally met, well, perhaps once, met people like that. But otherwise, it's just me projecting what their lives might be.
Profane, funny, sometimes confronting. This book is not for the easily offended. Hilarious, outrageous. There are brilliant linguistic gymnastics. Dappin brings to the book the quirky, insightful turn of phrase that makes his newspaper columns mandatory reading. A funny, over-the-top, well-written read, punctuated by lacerating comic dialogue and scenes of explosive violence, full of inventive wordplay and thinly veiled social commentary. There's ample substance beneath the dialogue. Explosive, gritty, hilarious, and best of all, truly original. The book detonates while you're reading it.
See, that's not true. It does not detonate while you're reading it.
That is written about your last book, though. And yet I found that it could easily describe this book. That this is not a book necessarily for the faint-hearted, for the gentle reader. This is a book that is for the adult reader. There's a lot of sex in it. There's not a lot of swearing. There's a little bit of violence. But it is a confronting book in that regard.
Yeah, I wanted it to be a confronting book. I wanted you to make choices about you, the reader, to make choices about what you're looking at, what you're listening to, what you're laughing at. I wanted the reader to be forced to stare at things that might appear obscene and disgusting and yet feel the thrill of them, of the sex, of the violence, of the situation, to feel it in some small way the way the men must have felt themselves. But they are very nice. Some of those bits of review you read out, I don't remember. But it's very nice of people to say so. I get the books. My books are always extremely well reviewed.
Well, let me say this:
no one buys them, but they're very well reviewed.
Well, they, you might want to buy R&R. Robert Drew said about
Rob, bless him,
King of the Cross, I think. Explosive, gritty, hilarious, and best of all, truly original. This book detonates while you're reading it. For this book, he said, more than witty, tough, and moving, it's explosive.
Mm.
So it detonates, and it's not actually, it's not like a landmine, although there is one of them in the book as well. And there is a pretty brutal scene, though, where a young Vietnamese boy is beaten up.
Mm-hmm.
Again, how do you write that? Tell me how you write a scene where someone is brutally beaten.
What I tried to contain within that scene was an idea. First, I wanted it to appear inevitable that it was going to occur, and I wanted the reader to feel throughout the preamble, no, no, don't let it happen, don't let it happen. I wanted the characters to be reluctant to allow it to happen and yet be swept away by the inevitability of the eventual explosion, detonation, or however Rob would like to describe it in this case. And then I wanted to show the hurt that violence inflicts. I wanted to depict the pain in a very kind of visceral way. And I wanted to show what it might be like to sort of turn a man to meat, because I wanted people to be horrified by it and turn away from it.
That certainly happened. Then the description also of what happens in a war and what happens when someone who's, you know, suffered from being blown up by a landmine goes into a hospital as well. And in fact, the most, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil the book for people, but when you are writing about the scene or you're writing about a moment where somebody dies and they don't really realise they're going to die until the very last moment is incredibly, profoundly moving, I found.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But I just made it up.
Just all invented. Quite an imagination. What I also like about the book, which is called R&R, it's by Mark Dappin, is the way that characters are brought in and out of the book, and they play their role, and then they a minor role first, perhaps, and then a major role, and then a minor role again, or the way that they're introduced, and maybe they only have a minor role. It's really superb writing in that regard. How do you do that? Do you have some sort of a timeline when you're sketching the outline of the book about where people appear?
No, not at all. What happens in every single book I write, I start off with far too many characters. And as soon as it gets to the first edit, the publisher says you've got to get rid of some of these characters. You've got to combine some of these characters. So I do that. And then the editor says again, once the publisher's had a go, there's too many characters. You've got to get rid of it. You've got to combine it. And so characters that I never envisaged in the first draft suddenly appear, and because they were previously two or even three characters, they kind of reappear at spaces where one part of them would have been before. And each time this happens, I say to myself, I'm not going to do this again. This time there are going to be eight characters in this book and that's it. But then they kind of spawn, they kind of split into other characters, and then they get pushed back into someone else. There's many characters left over from that. Many character sketches, which I thought were very strong, which I will use in the future. It was me kind of playing with life writing in a way. I was trying to build poetic, contrasting memoirs for people.
Because also there are characters, or at least mentions of characters, of people who appeared in a previous book about King's Cross.
Mm-hmm.
So are there characters in this book that might be spun off elsewhere?
Yeah, well, but the characters of Mendoza and Izzy Berger and maybe one or two others appear in both King of the Cross and Spirit House, my second novel. Again, what I'm... Sorry. What I'm trying to do is mess with people. I'm trying to write literature, but throw in the kind of Runyon-esque idea of serial characters that I know will annoy people. I think this isn't literature. It's rubbish. It's got all these people that were in the last one. It's not even about that. But that's just to mess with people and undermine my own credibility in a self-defeating manner.
Wow. Okay. One of the other things I noticed about the book is just about everybody is introduced or their character is expanded on by telling us where they came from. In fact, some of the characters, just the very minor characters, the Americans mostly, are known only by where they're from, their small town.
Yeah, again, this is probably something that came out of the Nashos War, because the most important thing about many Australian soldiers, it seemed to me, in their minds, was the state that they came from. You know, Western Australians were stuck together with Western Australians. South Australians might be seen as some kind of weird other race of shorter people with spires on their heads. I just hadn't realised there was that kind of state solidarity back in the day. The smaller you got, the closer people felt to one another. If there were two Catholic guys, they'd hang together. If there were two guys from Christian Brothers, they'd stay together. And if there were two guys from Christian Brothers in Tamworth, which actually there were, then they would feel the strongest of bonds. So I just kind of gave people geographical designations, not because I thought they were important, but I thought they were some way humorous sometimes, but because I suspect that's how they would have been known by their peers. Right. Oh, you know, there's that bloke from Idaho rather than that bloke who's, I don't know, any other designation you might give to him, bloke with size 8 feet or whatever.
He's not known by his name, he's known by his town.
Idaho, yeah.
Or Nashville.
Who does not, in fact, come from Nashville? Nah, he comes from Troy, Tennessee.
That's right. But calling him Troy would be too confusing because you'd think it was his name. And...
Yeah.
Who should read this book?
Everybody.
I know you'd like everyone to buy the book, but do you think everyone should read the book?
Oh, no, I don't care if anyone reads it, as long as everyone buys it. That's very, very important. When I started to write it, I had these grand visions of myself as Graham Greene. You may have noticed we have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm. I thought
both English and Yes, it's hard to think. I know we're both writers.
So Our Man in Havana type of thing, or?
No, not this one. My career. So I was thinking, okay, Spirit House, my previous novel, Bat Burma Railway, that was kind of a piece of literature. Rather like, perhaps, as you say, Our Man in Havana. But between his literature, Green wrote entertainments. And for me, R&R was going to be an entertainment. I just wanted to see if I could write a straight thriller. But of course, he didn't. I actually thought that's what I had submitted to the editor, to the publisher, rather. And he said, no, you've written literature again. So I'd failed in my attempt to write a thriller. And he said, we should be going for the Miles Franklin with this. You know, just tighten up the writing a bit, and yeah, we've got some more Australian literary fiction. But the initial aim was to write an entertainment that I thought might be read by men. It doesn't matter what I write, however, it's always read predominantly by women. Perhaps that's because women buy the majority of books here, and it always ends up some weird subgenre of literature.
But this is kind of genre fiction in a way. It's not what a lot of people would see as literary fiction that wins the Miles Franklin, although I certainly hope that you do, because it's an incredibly readable book, but there's plenty of other stuff there as well that makes you think about the human condition. And I mean, some of those scenes that you've written, the beating or the death, are as good as anything I've read in that regard.
Thank you.
There's a touch kind of Catch-22. There's a little bit of, I suppose, MASH in there as well. Anything else that we should be looking for?
Catch-22, I think, is a brilliant book and probably did have a huge influence on my life and writing, but it's been a long time since I read it. I would think as an actual influence stylistically, it's probably closer to Martin Amis than anything about the Vietnam War. Amis tried when he was good, a period which ended some time ago, I think, was always trying to write sentences that had not been written before. And when I write, that's what I try and do. There's a lot of R&R, which I hope is words put together in a unique manner, whereas a lot of books, you open them and they're just a string of formulaic constructions, things you've read before, dialogue you only see on TV. As I say, it was going to be a thriller. It was going to be genre fiction, hopefully superior genre fiction.
Yes.
And now it seems to kind of straddle some line between that and literary fiction. It's being promoted as literary fiction. It makes little difference to me.
And it should make little difference to the reader. They should just read it and enjoy it.
They should. I would hope it is enjoyable. And certainly, as I say, because I write so much about men, and also because I've edited men's magazines, people believe that men are my audience, but it's just not true. It's women, and it's women who have reviewed it so enthusiastically, with the exception of Rob, and it's women who will buy it, and it's women who come up to me and talk about it, but I've no idea why.
Well, I won't ask you then. It's called R&R. Mark Dappin is the author, and Mark, thank you very much. Congratulations.
No, thank you. Thank you.